Welcome to Thursday's edition of Main Street, right here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are pleased that you are with us today. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Dave Thompson, our news director, sorts the headlines from the hubbub in our weekly news review. Then Tom Ezern digs into the roots of spring with the Pasque, a poetic bloom with deep cultural meaning on the prairie. And Matt Olean sails us into the Ballad of Wallace Island in his movie review, where maps may lie, but the heart never does. And we begin Main Street today by visiting again with Caleb DeShock of Fenworks. Caleb, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And we're also joined by Hayden Sherva. He is the marketing coordinator at Fenworks. Hayden, it's good to visit with you again.
Yes, thanks for having me, Craig.
Caleb, we had you on just about a month ago in front of the North Dakota Esports State Championships. Before we get into everything drone racing, tell me about that event. How did it go?
The state tournament went fantastic. It has been exciting to see that this event that's been going on for nearly 5 years at this point has continued to grow, has continued to inspire students, has continued to develop friendships, academic outcomes, all of that stuff. So reflecting on how the state tournament went, the team at Fenworks left energized to go bigger and better for next year, just from the impact that we saw on hundreds of North Dakota students, you know, dozens of teams, dozens of schools. And it just reaffirms what we're doing in our mission. So it was a really great event.
You said hundreds of students. How many people participated?
We had over 300 students at the North Dakota State Tournament this year. But hundreds of spectators, family members, community people, and even thousands online tuned into the event. So it was a really great experience for that. And we've seen it just continue to develop over the last few years. So we're excited to see where it takes us.
We want to talk about drones today. And in fact, you have a drone league that you have been working with, and you have also an upcoming tournament. What is drone racing? How does that work? It seems to me like you would need football fields and football fields worth of space, but I have a feeling it's not that.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. But it's still a secret to others, though, that North Dakota is one of the capitals of drone activity, not just in the United States, but globally. And so to have that epicenter right here in the Red River Valley is critical to our development, to our growth. And one of the most important things that we can do if we want to be the epicenter of drone activity is to engage the K-12 age population, to get them excited about drones and UAS technology. And so our mission with our program is to get real drones and simulation drones in the hands of these students, to build a competition and activity, just like we did with esports, that mirrors traditional sports, and cap it off with a regional tournament. And so that is what we have done. The students are flying in computer simulations, just like esports, versing other teams across the state. And the students have physical drones, very small drones, that they can fly in cafeterias, gymnasiums, libraries, basically indoor flying, so they can learn the skills needed to be drone operators.
I can see school administrators maybe just covering their eyes here. Drones zipping around the cafeteria. How does that work in a relatively confined space?
Yeah. You know, it's really funny you bring up the administrators, because our team goes to so many conferences with these administrators. And it's really funny when we have a superintendent or an activities director or a tech director and a student at the conference, because sometimes those administrators will pick up the drone and crash it 10 times. But then the drone gets in the hand of a student who's a gamer and they fly it on their second try. And so the administrators are more worried when they fly than when the students are flying these things around them. But it's incredible to see the support that we've received from administrators across North Dakota, because so many of them are seeing the new drone jobs across the state, whether it's insurance agents, whether it's farmers, energy inspectors, pipeline, power line, wind turbine. These jobs require that you use drones as part of your day-to-day activity. And so the administrators have been super supportive, and we walk them through what it looks like to have them in the school, meaning students are going into these spaces, like a gymnasium, for example, and there's plenty of room to fly these very small drones. And so the students get the experience and the opportunity to fly these drones in the real world. And guess what? They get excited. They get bought in. And they say, well, wait a minute. I can stay in North Dakota, use this technology, work and live close to home and my family and my loved ones, and love my job too. So that's been a really exciting experience.
You've had a drone racing season now. Tell me, how is that structured, and how are schools and others participating?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about the experience that students have during the season first. So the students are doing two things, the simulation and the real world racing. So the students will go to a computer with the simulation for drone racing, and they can race other students across the state and across the region in that simulation. So they'll practice through their weekly matches, and then they will have game day, just like any other sport, and they'll have a season record, and if they win enough matches, they go to the regional tournament, just like any other sport, think track and field. And so the students are practicing those skills using the exact same transmitter or controller that they fly the drone with in the simulation and in the real world. And besides the simulation, they're using that controller. They're using the FPV goggles, so they're putting on the headset. And then they are flying in the real world, developing the skills that they learned in simulation. So the students are getting to participate in both. We're scoring those. And then that's the score that determines if they make it to the regional tournament. So deeply exciting. The students are building skills and learning all the time.
How long does a drone race take? And is it like laps around an oval course, or is it in and out and under and over and all of that stuff that I think that I've seen on TV?
Yeah, all of the above. And you're exactly right. You can see drone racing on all sorts of major networks now because it continues to grow as an activity. But you're right. It's up and down, left and right, bob and weave. And it's really exciting, right? The students are practicing such fine motor skills when they're flying these drones, both in simulation and in the real world. So we'll develop these courses over the course of the season that increase in complexity and difficulty so that the students are building more and more and more skills each week. And you're exactly right. They're racing around obstacles. They're avoiding each other. And those skills just continue to make them better operators. And it's exciting. The kids love it.
And again, how long does the race take? Is it like five minutes, or is it like 2 hours? Or?
Great question. Yeah, under 5 minutes per race. So we might do two or three races, do best of three. And, you know, the races take about, you know, 15 minutes in total when you do all of the races. You know, as you progress in the competition, we might move to best of five, best of seven, and things like that, too.
So are the obstacles, if there are obstacles that you've encountered with drone racing and developing a drone racing league and a regional tournament, are they the same kind of obstacles that esports have kind of, you've endured with esports, like not understanding, thinking that, oh, those guys are gamers, when no, those guys are gamers. And it's just a different way to look at students who are very, very interested. And like you said earlier, this also could be the varsity quarterback and the leader of the band and the debate team person who's just really, really good, as well as maybe folks who haven't participated, students who haven't participated in many, if any, extracurricular activities. Yeah. Is it the same in drone racing?
You hit the nail on the head. You're speaking my language. You're exactly right. The students that we see in drone racing come from a variety of backgrounds, right? These are students who are deeply interested in their future. They want to know what they're going to be when they grow up. And they come from all of the backgrounds. They're sports kids, fine arts kids, STEM kids, and kids that we haven't been able to engage in our academic settings yet. And that means we're bringing kids together, developing new friendships, developing those teamwork leadership skills that we've talked about before that we see in other activities. And as we try to solve some of these challenges, culturally, that's what we need people to understand. These activities are giving kids an opportunity to express themselves, to make those new friends, to learn those job skills. And so we have to work together with our partners like you, Craig, to get the message out that these experiences are life-changing for these kids. We have students who are in drone racing who are also working at the school paper and want to use drones as part of that. Or they're part of a media and broadcasting class and they want to use drones as part of that. Or they're part of a business club or a farming program like FFA and they want to use drones. So the utility of drones is in every aspect of modern life, and the students understand that. They know that if they can't use drones, they're going to struggle in the workforce. Now we need the rest of our decision makers, our fellow citizens, to understand we need to support this so that these kids can have a successful future. I know a lot of my friends personally have had to go get their Part 107, which is commercial licensing to use drones, because their job has started to leverage UAS technology and they need them to be trained and operating these drones. So we're already seeing this reskilling happen in the current workforce to adopt this technology.
We are enjoying our conversation with Caleb DeShock. He is the visionary CEO of FenWorks, based out of Grand Forks. Also with us is Hayden Sherva, the marketing coordinator for FenWorks. Hayden, let me ask you, what is the schedule? The season is in play, right? And you're building up to this regional tournament. And also, how do you communicate to school districts, to individual students? How are you getting the word out?
Yes, sir. Yeah. So right now we are in the towards the end of the season with the drone racing regionals taking place on May 3rd and 4th at NDSU in Fargo. The season lengths for each of our states is 2 weeks of preseason and then 6 weeks of regular season, two more weeks of the regional drone racing preparation, and then the regional tournament. The main communication that we give out to our student pilots and the families and the schools, right now it's mainly through Facebook and LinkedIn. We will post job opportunities in the region for those who have a Part 107 or those who are part of our drone racing program. That's something that they can look forward to with the skills that they learned in our program. We will post the leaderboards of the fastest times or the fastest teams for each week with a custom graphic so that people can see who's in lead and they can get a good idea as to who's probably going to make it to the regional drone racing tournament.
So is this an individual and a team-based competition?
Yes. Yep. It can be both.
Can you give me the leaders of the team in the team-based competition so far?
So the top five teams that we have right now are the top five schools in drone racing is Grand Forks Red River at number one, Fargo Public Schools at number two, Eden Prairie High School at number three, Jamestown High School at number four, and Marty Indian School sitting at number five spot.
That should become part of the sports report, it seems to me.
Yes.
Let me ask you, how do you know that what you're doing is successful? In other words, I'm sure it's growth, right?
Yeah. Craig, you're exactly right. Every year we look at our drone racing program, we see the amount of students participating increase. We see the amount of schools participating increase. Those are two sort of guideposts for us. But also, we start hearing stories of our students going into workforce, higher ed, and the armed services and using drones, pursuing drone majors. You know, NDSCS and Bismarck State College launched college drone racing to accompany their academic programs that are so UAS focused. And so now we have this pipeline where students are competing in K through 12, going to college, competing and learning, and then they will then go into workforce, skilled, trained, and passionate about what they do.
Is there any pushback that you aren't monitored, or maybe you are, supported by the North Dakota High School Activities Association, that you're kind of this independent thing, or is that kind of working in your favor?
Yeah, a great question. North Dakota High School Activities has been fantastic to work with. And for us, especially with drone racing, which is so new, we really want to get out there and prove that this is something to stay, that this is a really great benefit to students, and that we want to continue to improve on it before we have 120 high schools doing it, right? And so folks over at North Dakota High School Activities, like Matt Fetch, have been nothing but supportive, nothing but thoughtful. And, you know, they check in and they ask, hey, how are things going? Anything that we should know? So they've been great partners. And if it makes sense to have drone racing be part of that lineup one day, you know, I know that they'll be super responsive and open to it. But at the same time, we have so much development left to do to make sure it's in a great spot for all of our students in North Dakota, since it's so new.
Do you envision one day that it will be part of what's offered by the North Dakota High School Activities Association?
Yeah, you know, I think North Dakota High School Activities is really thoughtful and is really looking out for the best interests of students across North Dakota. And as a kid who participated in a lot of different North Dakota high school activities, both sports and fine arts, you know, I was really lucky that I got to do those activities. I think you're also seeing that high school activities associations across the country are looking at STEM activities and saying, hey, this is the only thing missing from our lineup. Robotics, esports, now drone racing, and then we want to do coding competitions too. I think you will see partnerships established with folks like North Dakota High School Activities to offer these more complicated but also valuable STEM activities. So stay tuned for that. But yes, I think in the future we'll have those partnerships.
Walk us back a little bit and tell us the history of FenWorks for our listeners.
Absolutely. So 5-6 years ago, I was at the University of North Dakota as a huge nerd and a huge gamer building the program at the Wellness Center to connect gaming, esports, and physical health, mental health, social health, the dynamics of wellness together for our student body. And K-12 educators loved that approach. So they were coming to the university, and the university was directing them to me and saying, hey, talk to this young nerd we have. He's going to tell you a little bit about how these STEM activities are producing really positive health outcomes. And from there, FenWorks was founded, and we ran to as many K-12 schools to talk about the benefits for students to participate in these activities. So for over 4 years now, we've been working with these K-12 schools to connect young people back to their community, back to the real world, focusing on academic outcomes, focusing on social and mental health outcomes, and it's been deeply positive. We've had so many great partners, and a lot of administrators took the time to hear it here. They put their trust in us, and we can see the results over the last 4 years have been nothing short of phenomenal. Genuinely fastest growing activities.
Would you classify yourself more as like a marketing group, a software development group, all of the above? Are you coordinating and developing software for these competitions?
Yeah, all of the above is a great answer, Craig. We have a software platform, and that's used to run the competitions, to organize the students, and to support these new STEM activities. But we also are deeply involved in training and educating both educators, the students, administrators, because this is new. There is not an established infrastructure to support people as they're launching this. So we've become that infrastructure. And then we do so much more. We're officiating all of these games in esports and drone racing. We're watching the scores as they come in, supporting teams as they compete and get into their matches, handling disputes, whether that's a rule dispute or a score dispute. We handle all of that work so that the administrators and the educators can focus on producing great outcomes for the students. We'll handle all the boring back-end work.
So let's turn our attention back to the regional drone racing championships. It's coming up the first part of May at NDSU. What are we going to see? Is it open to the public? Can we come and watch?
Yes. So the regional tournament is going to be open to the public. It's going to be free for everyone to come and watch. If you aren't able to make it in person, we'll also be streaming it on the FenWorks YouTube channel at FenWorks Official. And that will be streamed all day for both days. During the competition, you're going to see both virtual and in-person drone racing through a track that we set up with our obstacles.
What are obstacles? What do they look like in a drone racing competition? Is this like a football field size of place with things to, again, go over and under and through and all this kind of stuff? Are they kind of blow up things that you guys bring to these competitions?
Yeah. So we have custom obstacles that we bring to these events and to give to the school districts as part of the program. And so you have these bars that look like hurdles, if you want to compare it to a more known factor. So you have these hurdle bars that you go over and under. And then we have flags that direct you whether you go left of the flag or right of the flag as you're completing a few laps around the course. And then we host that in one of the major ballrooms at NDSU because we do need a lot of space for it. And there's a level of verticality that we do with the up and down on the hurdles.
How fast are the drones going when they're going through this course?
You know, I think we top out at about 25 miles per hour, but the course is not very long, so it's more about control. So you'll see more on average 10 to 15 miles.
When I've watched this on television, it's almost hard for me to see whether the drone has went where it's supposed to have gone, if it didn't go outside or inside of the particular, thing that's in front of it there. Do you have replay? How do you make sure you're scoring it right? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it's so interesting because when you're officiating drone racing as a sport, you have your timekeepers, you have people watching the course, you have, I don't even know what to call the technology, but when you're looking at an obstacle, some of the obstacles will report feedback to us saying, hey, they properly crossed this.
Oh, the obstacle itself is kind of wired and you can, okay, that makes sense. Sure.
Yep. So there's a lot of technology going into events like this, but we're so nerdy, we wouldn't want it any other way.
Are you worried that AI is going to impact how people are interested in what you're doing in the future? Like, I think of drones, for example, and I think of how AI likely will at least, you know, impact the industry at the very, very general level. Mm-hmm. What have you thought about that?
Yeah. And when I think about AI, and you just see news story after news story after news story on AI, the truth is AI is a reason to actually engage more in the STEM space. You know, in the industry, a lot of these UAS drones have phenomenal stabilization. They can be programmed. And so certain activities don't even require operators, but they do require people who are passionate, fascinated, and understand the underlying technology regarding the operation of these drones in terms of flight, but also coding and manufacturing. So we're going to continue to build out our program to have more and more of those offerings so that we're preparing the next generation.
People want to learn more about everything that's happening. Where should they go?
They should go over to finworks.com. You can find all of our information there,
including schedules and a schedule of events for your regional tournament that's happening on the campus of North Dakota State University. That is on May 3rd and May 4th. We are looking forward to that. Is it loud? Is a drone competition loud? Do I hear going around all over the place?
You will a little bit, but it is not as loud as one might think, maybe minus the cheering and celebrating from the teams.
There you go. Our guests have been Caleb DeShock. He's the CEO of Fenworks, and also Hayden Sherva. He is the marketing coordinator for Fenworks. It's a company that's based in Grand Forks and is a leader in incorporating esports and drone racing into high school activities. Gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to visit with you, and best wishes for your upcoming regional drone tournament.
Thank you, Craig.
Yes, thank you, Craig. Thanks for having us again. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come on Main Street, Dave Thompson sorts through the headlines you need to know. Tom Ezern uncovers the deeper meaning behind the prairie's first flower. And Matt Olean maps out a mysterious island tale in his movie review, The Ballad of Wallace Island. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
It's time to welcome back to Main Street our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Craig. How about you?
I am doing fine, Dave. And of course, we review the news each and every week here on Main Street with you, Dave. And we're pleased that you're able to take time with us. Let's begin with how changes might impact when mail ballots are going to be due in the state.
This is based on the executive order that President Trump issued. And what the state had a 13-day acceptance period for absentee ballots that came in after Election Day if they were postmarked the day prior to the election. But the executive order says basically they have to be in by Election Day or they should not count.
Okay, Dave, let's move along. Our governor, Kelly Armstrong, has now vetoed really a controversial library content bill.
This library content bill that was passed this session basically could criminalize librarians if they found with inappropriate material in children's sections and things like that. It would be public libraries and school libraries. Well, the governor said it's gone too far. 2 years ago, they passed another library bill just basically to try to get some of that more sexually explicit content off the shelves and into, the adult sections. So they're going to try to override it, but I don't think they have the votes to override the veto on this one.
The House now has advanced $50 million in additional state funds for the presidential library.
This is an amendment to the Department of Commerce bill. It was approved on Wednesday. It would add $50 million in state funding, plus a $20 million Bank of North Dakota loan for the presidential library. The $50 million would go toward a permanent endowment and would be used as a fundraising tool for a 2-to-1 match to try to raise money to keep the library fully funded for years to come.
There was lengthy discussion, Dave, and this wasn't an overwhelmingly positive vote. It was 53-40 in the House.
That is correct. And what they said, and I go back to when this was first proposed, back in the mid-2010s. They came to the legislature, said we'd like $50 million, and we won't come back. Well, the $50 million that was approved then would be for maintenance of the library. Well, they came back in a way to kind of leverage another $50 million to do some fundraising, and that caused some objections on the floor. But the supporters say, look, who's getting a presidential library these days? This is something North Dakota can be proud of. This is something North Dakota should invest in.
Dave, back to the legislature, North Dakota's Governor Kelly Armstrong also vetoed the ESA bill, which allowed for school choice, saying that it falls short. First, why did he veto it, and what did he mean when it says it falls short?
Okay, this bill that was passed, this House Bill 1540, only applied to people who send their kids to parochial schools, to private schools. The other bill that was pending would also allow homeschoolers and public school kids to have these ESAs as well. So that's the bill the governor wanted, and they're going to try to override this veto too, but on the same calendar is that other bill, and that's the one that the governor prefers in order to expand it, broaden it, so more people and more families are involved.
Why would a public school student, Dave, need an educational savings account?
Here's why. At least that this is the thought, because now you might have to pay extra money to take music lessons, music classes, that type of thing. Or if you want to go into, some of the skills centers and there's a tuition with that, then you'd have these education savings accounts that will help you pay for the music lessons, for the skills and life training stuff.
Dave, who do you have appearing on the North Dakota Legislative Review this week? And I should remind our listeners that you can watch the North Dakota Legislative Review with Dave Thompson and his guests Fridays at 7:30 p.m. on the television service of Prairie Public. But Dave, go ahead, give us a little promo for what's coming up.
Now, who we have is the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Brad Beckedahl of Williston. Not only is he going to talk about spending, he's also on the conference committee dealing with the property tax relief. So he's got a lot to say.
Dave Thompson, he and I review the news each and every week from the legislature now, but always from the entire state. Dave, it's a pleasure to visit with you.
Thanks, Craig. Glad to be here.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
With that fanfare, it's a reminder, of course, that it's Thursday and time for another edition of Going to the Movies with our great friend Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Film today is an interesting film, Matt. It's really one that I want to see. I'm glad that you've seen it and will review it. It's The Ballad of Wallace Island. Here's the trailer.
We'll always have this island and your beautiful music.
Go! Oh, yes, indeed.
You made it, okay?
Is there not like a harbour?
It's sort of nature's harbour.
Welcome to Wallace Island.
No!
Do you sell rice? My fire got wet.
We've got pasta.
Has to be rice, apparently.
Oh, you've got rice pudding, look.
Rice pudding definitely won't work.
Well, not with that attitude. No, it won't.
You know it isn't.
The great Herb Maguire.
Coming all the way out here without your roadies.
Which brings me up to the thorny issue
of payment.
Where will the audience be?
You said there'd be 100.
I said less than 100.
Is it just you?
Yeah.
Right.
I'm literally playing to one guy.
I'm going to have to take out a restraining order.
Can you shut the door?
Absolutely.
No, I meant...
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I'm so sorry.
I'm not really used to having guests.
Please not today.
So, what's happened with you and Nell Mortimer? When was the last time you played together?
I'm quite a private person, to be honest.
I know you are. But go on, what happened?
Do you invite Nell?
Yeah, she's...
With Michael.
Who's Michael?
Her husband.
Oh.
In a good way, or...
You knew I was coming, right?
Matt, this trailer to me is just funny and also maybe introspective. What did you think of the movie?
Loved it. This is the first film of 2025 where I've walked out of the theater just feeling happier, you know? And I wasn't sure what to expect going in, but it's funny, it's touching, it's poignant. It never gets maudlin, which is a word I like to use where you kind of go over that line. It's that weird line in movie making and TVs is, you know, when does it become sappy? When does it become silly? And nobody... No country can pull off these kind of delightful comedies, usually set in a little village with quirky characters like the Brits can do. They've done this for years. It goes back to the Ealing studio years of the 1940s and 50s with movies like Whiskey Galore and the Lavender Hill Mob and the Titfield Thunderbolt and just great little movies like that about typically villagers that are quirky. And that's what you have here on this little island near Great Britain, where a character named Charles lives, played wonderfully by Tim Key. He steals the movie as this kind of buffoonish guy who has magically won the lottery twice. So he's got all kinds of money living on this island, and he wants to spend it in one way. He wants to bring back the folk music duo of Maguire and Mortimer, played by Tom Basden and Carey Mulligan. Carey Mulligan's kind of the star of this movie, or the name person. So that's his whole goal, as you can hear in the trailer. His goal is to bring back these two people to perform a concert in front of, as he puts it, less than 100 on the island. He's going to pay them money. This is a private gig. And that is his goal, is to get these two people together who have not performed in years. They're not a romantic couple anymore. And so he's got to figure out a way to get them to this island and have them perform. Wonderful performances by Tom Basden as Herb Maguire, who's kind of this, oh, he views himself way too seriously as a musician and artist, and he's grumpy. He doesn't want to be there, even though he's getting paid £500,000 to be there. Carey Mulligan plays Nell Mortimer, the female half of the folk duo. She's wonderful as well. Doesn't have as big a part as Tim Key and Tom Basden do. This is based on a short film made about 15 years ago by Key and Basden. They are notable comedians in Great Britain and poets. And Tom Basden wrote all the songs for this movie as well. So it is what it does. Is it walks that fine line, Craig, between sappy and funny and poignant. There are moments in this film that are hilarious. Tim Key, the way he talks all the time, his character talks all the time. He's the comic touch of this movie, but it's really about the passage of time. It's about the effect that music can have on us and how important music and some people can be, how important certain famous people can be in our lives. That's really what it's about. And the film also, I would say, Craig, without letting plot details go, it doesn't really go where I think it's going to go. You know, you kind of think it is heading toward this predictable ending, and it doesn't really go there. It kind of takes a mild left turn in the third act, that I liked, that I think was realistic, but still kind of works. And I don't mean to put down American comedies, because there's so many good American comedies, but I do find with films like this, American romantic comedies or comedies, they just don't stick the landing like some of these British films do. And this is a really good film. I urge people to go see it. My friend and I saw it the other night, and she enjoyed it as well. And there were quite a few people. This was a 4:45 showing on a Monday, and there were a lot of people in the theater. So again, there's a lot of appetite, as we know here at PBS, right, Craig, for British adventures, British drama, British comedies. And this one is right along those lines. If you like, you know, if you like British programming on PBS, I think you're going to like this movie a lot.
Matt, the film's setting looks like it's on a cool island. Maybe it's a fictional island. What did the cinematography and direction, how did it make use of the landscape to kind of deepen the narrative of this fun film?
Yeah, very, very remote setting. It was filmed in Wales. And, you know, the island is populated by British people, not too many people on the island. But it, I mean, that's a character. The island is a character in the movie, this remote island. And for Maguire and Mortimer to get there, some hilarious scenes as they're kind of being brought in by, not by big boat, not by airplane. They're being brought in by these little tiny boats that they're brought in, and they can't quite get them to shore. So that's a hilarious scene as well. But yeah, it definitely makes use of the island as a character. And again, you feel that Charles inhabits this island. This is where he wants to be. You feel like he's lonely. He's got his own tennis court, which is kind of a which leads to some funny scenes as well, because he has nobody.
He serves very well, doesn't he, Matt?
He does, but he has nobody to play with. So his return of serve needs some work. So he's looking for Herb to play tennis with him. Herb is a grouch in the movie, as I told you. Tom Basden plays him. Definitely is a grouchy artist who wants to go solo and has kind of forgotten about the Maguire and Mortimer duo. But as I said, I think it takes a kind of a left turn in the third act that I liked, and it kind of sticks the landing, I would say. The film doesn't outstay its welcome. It's about an hour and 40 minutes. That's about what it should be. Like I said, this is the first, I think, really delightful film of 2025. And when I say delightful, it's not maudlin. Like, as I said, it just really sticks the landing between comedy, poignancy. There's some really good scenes in here that are touching as well. You kind of feel this buffoonish guy named Charles. You feel that he can be overbearing. He talks too much, but you also kind of like him as well.
Wondering, Matt, if there's a film in Academy Award history, and we'll get to our trivia question here in just a little bit, that this reminds you of.
It reminds me of old British films and new British films, too. You know, things like Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, even those aren't set on islands, but all those films have a variety of quirky kind of characters that are very British in their own way. And so that's kind of what it reminds me of. It's the Brits have a different way of doing comedy. You know, those of us who grew up watching PBS and having Monty Python's Flying Circus on at 10 p.m. on Sunday nights, that was a big deal to watch that
every
show.
Every Sunday, Matt.
Every Sunday night. And it was, you know, very different from American television. And, you know, their movies are, They're slightly different than American comedies, and it's hard to put a finger on that. But this one, again, I think sticks the landing. I think people will really like this film. The accents are a little tricky to understand here and there, but overall, I was able to follow what everybody was saying. And Tim Key, as I said, as Charles, really steals the movie.
What's the path for a movie like this that kind of has a wonderful opening? It's been on the circuit, so to speak. And now, where does it go? Does it grow some legs here?
Oh, yeah, I think it grows a lot of legs. It did very well at Sundance, and the word of mouth on this is really good. I want to give the director, Ryan James Griffiths, a lot of credit, because this is a film that could go off the rails very easily with over-the-top stuff, and, you know, but he kind of keeps that deft touch, that deft comic and poignant touch throughout. So I think the word of mouth on this is going to be great. It's going to be, you know, out there in theaters for people to see. And of course, a lot of people don't go to theaters anymore, so they'll find it on streaming. I encourage people to try to see this. I saw it at the Fargo Theater. So I think the word of mouth is going to be very good on this, and I think it's going to do very well.
All right, Matt, for our trivia portion of the show. Matt, this movie was released in 2020. It's a poetic meditation on solitude, community, and resilience in American landscape. In 2021, which movie won the Best Picture?
Nomadland.
we have been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nicole's Fine Pastry and Cafe on 8th Street South in Fargo. Open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., offering small batch baked goods, house-made soups, and more, with a second location at Brewhalla. Learn more at nicolesfinepastry.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Tom Ezern, in this Plainsfolk essay, reflects on The Pasque, which explores the early spring bloom's role in settler and Dakota traditions, symbolizing renewal and ritual. He reflects on its cultural interpretations and enduring message of hope.
This sort of notice appeared ritually in the newspapers of the Settler Society on the Northern Plains sometime in April. I quote from the Griggs County Courier-Democrat, 29 April 1909. The Pasque flower, or prairie crocus, the first flower of spring, is showing its head above ground. Now from the Hope Pioneer, 27th of April 1939. The first flower to appear in the spring on the prairie is the Pasque flower, commonly known as crocus. The general blooming of the Pasque flower begins about the middle of April. Given the season of appearance, the settlers called this native anemone the Pasque, associating it with the Passion and Easter. In 1916, a new Ph.D. in botany, Melvin Gilmore, arrived in Bismarck to take up duties as curator of the State Historical Museum. He took an interest in ethnobotany, the native use of plants, doing fieldwork among the Arikara, and also, it appears to me, receiving Dakota lore by way of Reverend Aaron McAfee Bede at Standing Rock. In 2021, Gilmore published his slender book, Prairie Smoke, a collection of lore and plant ways in which he taps indigenous tradition as to prairie crocus. Hokshni Chekpa in Dakota, which may have meant twin flower, because the lavender blossoms came in clusters, or perhaps navel flower, because the buds looked like a baby's navel. All such ethnological work wants reading with a couple of grains of salt and a tolerance for patronizing rhetoric, as Gilmore recounts the pretty little stories given by Dakota people around Hokshni Chekpa. He relates that when a Dakota elder found the first flower of spring, he would sit with it, fill his pipe, raise it in the four directions, smoke, and then reflect on the course of his life. After that, he would carry a blossom to his grandchildren, singing a ritual song in which the first flower exhorts others to emerge without fear. I believe Bede brought the translation of this song to Gilmore. Down at Yankton, a Benedictine, the Reverend Ignatius Forster, chaplain to the Sacred Heart Convent, read Gilmore's narrative and was taken with it. He thereupon composed his own riff on the Dakota song, which he intended, it appears to me, for use among the sisters. His ballad retains the Dakota scenario of the emergence of the Pasque and its encouragement to other flowers, but concludes with what seems a gratuitous stanza exhorting everyone to work unto the grave. It's dissonant and disrespectful of Dakota tradition, but I suppose you have to consider it in the Benedictine context of a life of service. When I sing Forster's spring anthem, I leave off the work stanzas and let the more poetic parts stand. Also, since there is appropriation all over this episode of literary history, I have appropriated a sacred tune to which to sing it. So, here are a couple of stanzas of hope for the season. Lovely Pasque flower, herald of spring, proclaiming the hour gladly to sing. Gently thou greetest the winter sun, boldly thou peepest if snow is gone. Callest thy playmates who still do sleep, arise, lo, spring waits, no longer weep. Slowly they waken, slowly they sigh. Wasn't that beckoning past flowers cry?
That was our dear friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, with another of his Plainsfolk essays. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he shares his essays with our Prairie Public audience.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Beer, Brats, and Brass, featuring the brass and percussion sections performing jazz, classical, funk, and polka. Friday, May 2nd at 6 p.m. at Drecker Brahalla. Ticket information at fmsymphony.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 24th. In the early 1800s, the government had to figure out what to do with people already claiming land in the West. On this date in 1820, Congress passed the Land Act, allowing settlers to purchase the land they had claimed. They could buy 160 acres at $1.25 per acre. The Land Act made it possible for people of modest means to purchase land and settle down. They also marked the beginning of an organized effort to settle the West. It was a good deal for speculators, too. Those with plenty of money could buy low-cost land and resell it at higher prices. But it was not good for Native Americans. The Act increased the confiscation of their land and raised the chances of conflict between the original inhabitants and the European-American newcomers. The Homestead Act of 1862 is perhaps the best-known government effort to promote Western settlement. The Act allowed any citizen or intended citizen who had never taken up arms against the U.S. government to claim 160 acres of land. Original filers who lived on the land for 5 years and improved it could claim the property for a small filing fee. But when those settlers arrived, they found that some adventurous souls had already set up housekeeping, thanks to the Land Act of 1820. Also in 1862, President Lincoln signed the Morrill Act. It gave each state a minimum of 90,000 acres of land to sell. The money was used to establish colleges focused on engineering, agriculture, and military science. North Dakota Agricultural College, now North Dakota State University, was established in Fargo as the state's land-grant college. Other land acts followed. The Timber Culture Act of 1874 encouraged homesteading and tree planting. Homesteaders who occupied their land for 3 years with at least 1 acre devoted to trees were eligible to receive a land patent. Civil War veterans could also claim 160 acres. The United States began as a country perched on the Atlantic seaboard, but by 1840, 40% of the population lived in the trans-Appalachian West. The land acts passed by the federal government helped drive that continued westward movement. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
The public is pouring in to view Pope Francis's remains before his funeral Saturday. As mourners continue to grieve, cardinals from around the world will soon prepare to elect the next leader of the world's 1.4 billion Roman Catholics. We'll tell you what's in store as global figures pay their last respects to the first pontiff from Latin America on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you very much for joining us today. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. The topic this week, how do you feel about the power of billionaires in our government? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a wonderful North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again on Monday, right back here on Main Street.